Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. The foster care system aims to care for some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society, abused and neglected children. According to the White House, on any given day, 400,000 children are in foster care in the United States. One out of four is waiting to be adopted. And each year, 23,000 of these youth will age out of the system. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says the average length of stay is a little more than 1 year, but 13% of children remain in foster care for 3 or more years. Former foster care children face tough odds. Studies indicate they are more likely than their peers to end up in jail or homeless or to become pregnant. According to the national nonprofit Foster Care to Success, half do not graduate high school by age 18, about two-thirds never attend college, and fewer than 1 out of every 10 former foster youth obtain a bachelor's degree. In recent years, Maryland has reduced the number of children in foster care from 10,330 in June 2007 to 5,036 in November 2014, half as many over 7 years. Today, we're going to discuss an ongoing debate about how state and federal governments fund the foster care system and other programs for vulnerable people. Should states be limited in how they use federal benefits for which some foster children qualify? Should states be able to seize property or assets that children already own when they enter the system? These are questions raised by Daniel Hatcher, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, in his new book, The Poverty Industry: The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. It's published this week by New York University Press. Before Daniel Hatcher joined the UB faculty, he worked as Assistant Director of Advocacy for Public Benefits and Economic Stability for the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. He was also staff attorney for legal aid in the Baltimore Child Advocacy Unit, representing abused and neglected children. And Daniel Hatcher is here in Studio A with me. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you so much for coming. What do you mean by the poverty industry?
Sure. Well, the poverty industry, I guess to start, usually when we think of an industry, we're thinking of a grouping of companies that provides a similar service or product. We can think of the coal mining industry. With the poverty industry, you actually have state governments and state human service agencies partnering with private contractors, revenue contractors, seeking to mine children, much like we would mine rock for coal ore, actually mine children and the poor for revenue that is then unfortunately often diverted to general state coffers rather than using the money for the intended purposes.
And so when you say you're mining for revenue, is there any source other than federal benefits? This is a way of finding out whether there are federal benefits that these citizens, you focus a lot on foster care children, but other vulnerable populations also, whether they're eligible for federal benefits.
Right. Well, so with foster children, states, human service agencies, foster care agencies across the country are targeting disability and survivor benefits for the elderly in our nursing homes. Often it's Medicaid benefits. School children as well, sometimes school-based Medicaid benefits. You can actually have the same child who's in foster care, and the state might be targeting their survivor disability benefits or more. Nebraska, I use as an example, will even take a burial plot from children to repay cost of care. Maryland will even take a child's own earnings. But then they'll also target Medicaid funds. New Jersey has a program in place where the Christie administration is forcing school districts to participate in this revenue maximization scheme. And then the state to claim more school-based Medicaid funds intended for school children for special education services. And then the administration is routing 80% of those funds to general state coffers. Meanwhile, the state of New Jersey, their schools are so underfunded, they're selling advertisements on school buses.
So the reason you call this an industry is because state agencies hire profit-making consultants to find the recipients of these benefits? Is it the participation of the profit-making businesses, the consultants, that offends you?
That's definitely a part of it. And I am concerned when a state works with a private contractor, like in Maryland, they have a state contract with Maximus regarding foster children's benefits. And that is part of the industry that I'm talking about. But at the end of the day, it's the state government leaders. It's the governors of our states, and it's the leaders of our human service agencies that are constructing these contracts, that are determining the scope and the structure, and then ultimately determining how the money should be used, right? So it's our governor in Maryland who is deciding that when we use Maximus to obtain more disability and survivor benefits from children who have dead parents or are disabled, it's our governor who's deciding those funds should be routed to general state coffers rather than actually used to benefit the children.
Okay. Is this something you find in all states, this practice?
That practice is happening in all states. Not all states are yet using revenue maximization contractors, but that's increasing across the country.
So that element, the contractors element of the industry, the poverty industry that you describe, is not universal in the United States yet.
It's not universal and the foster care agencies claiming disability benefits and survivor benefits. It's present in virtually every state in other categories, if not there, like Medicaid claiming federal foster care 4E funds under Section 4E of the Social Security Act.
Back up for me, because I think some of our listeners may be thinking, okay, child is being cared for by the state, has access to a stream of income from a benefit, a Social Security benefit of some sort, let's say that was earned by their parent who's now deceased. What is the problem with the state using that money for that child's care and maintenance?
Right. And maybe I can use an example of a former foster child that I represented in Maryland. He entered the foster care system at age 12 when his mother died. And then they were looking to an older brother as a potential resource. Unfortunately, his brother
died. Potential resource meaning that he might go live with his brother.
That's right, a placement resource. Unfortunately, his brother dies. Then they locate his father, and his father was a potential placement resource, and then his father dies. You know, so this poor kid, he's no longer a kid, but you know, all his family members are dying. And then the foster care agency realizes that because his father died, his father worked, paid into the system, earned a survivor benefit under the Social Security program, right? This is a benefit that then belongs to the child. The state went after that, never told the foster child that it was applying for the benefits, never told the foster child that the agency was applying to take over control of the money as representative payee, which is a fiduciary role, and then diverted those funds. The agency indicates like they're using the funds to reimburse foster care costs. The problem with that rationale is states are already legally obligated to provide foster care both under federal and state law. Foster children rightfully have no legal debt obligation to pay for their own care, right? You know, these children aren't the ones who decide to put themselves in foster care or to be subjected to abuse and neglect. So we as a society should not be forcing them to pay for their own foster care. And then...
So this is, I think, where I'm not with you in the analysis.
Sure.
Because it seems to me that you're essentially saying that even if federal taxpayers are through Social Security benefits or veteran survivors benefits or some kind of federal benefit, even if federal taxpayers are providing an income stream for the care and maintenance of that individual, that state taxpayers still have to pay for it. That Maryland taxpayer, that there's no way if the Maryland agency thinks this child needs to be in foster care, that's totally a responsibility of state taxpayers, even if federal taxpayers are supplying something. That's not obvious to me as a taxpayer.
Well, to start, the cost of the foster care system is shared by the federal government and states. The largest funding source is under Title 4E of the Social Security Act, which is matching. And in most states, the federal government pays a larger share of the funds than the state governments. But there's federal law and state law that requires states to provide foster care services. The other element of this is when the state becomes representative payee for these children's survivor benefits or disability benefits, they're intended to serve the best interests of the individual child. That's their purpose. The money is an entitlement that belongs to the children. It's a property right. So when the foster care agency becomes representative payee, they're a fiduciary. under federal law.
Which fiduciary simply means what you just said.
Yeah, they have
your responsibility is to, in the best interest of the person for whom you're fiduciary.
Look at a variety of different ways you could use the money, decides what's best for this individual child, right? But instead, the agency is applying a blanket rule and taking the funds from every child in foster care to apply to reimburse a cost that the child has no legal obligation to pay for.
And is that established in law, that the child has no obligation even if the child has assets?
Even the Supreme Court has actually recognized that the children have no legal debt obligation to pay for their own care. Now, some states through regulation, Maryland has a regulation that, you know, not only will it take survivor benefits and disability benefits, it'll go after more. If a child comes into foster care with savings, with insurance, even the child's own earnings. As I mentioned, Nebraska, you know, have a long list of what the state may take from foster children, including burial plots.
How did you become aware of this issue?
My first legal aid job almost 20 years ago was representing children in the Baltimore foster care system. So, you know, so I encountered an unfortunately and often broken system at that time. And then through that work and then through doing policy work, I eventually encountered the practice where these foster care agencies, that their sole reason for existing is to serve the best interests of children in their care, are actually taking resources from the children in their care. So that, you know, charged me into looking into the research behind it, and I got involved in litigation. And then I expanded my advocacy into other areas where I've seen this. Child support is also being taken from children in foster care, or children whose parents receive public benefits. Medicaid, you know, with foster children.
Zero in on child care for me for a minute. What's going on with child care that you think fits into this same?
On child support.
Child support, mm-hmm. Excuse me, child support that fits into this picture.
So for a foster child, again, for example, when the child's in foster care, not only will the states go after their disability and survivor benefits, they'll also go after both parents, and usually the parents are poor. The vast majority of foster children in our country come from poor families, and most of the children come into care not because of abuse. There is some cases of abuse, obviously, but the vast majority is through neglect, not abuse, as a result of poverty. They'll go after these impoverished parents for child support, but it's not money that actually ever goes to benefit the child. Rather, the states will take that money again to reimburse the cost of care. There's actually a report in Maryland. Maryland hired Maximus to do an assessment report.
Maximus, again, is this contractor, this private business.
Right. And Maximus indicated in the assessment report that there was potential concern that the agencies in Maryland weren't tracking how much child support they were also taking from the children. So they might actually be taking both child support and disability or survivor benefits from the same children.
We need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the so-called poverty industry and its impact on foster care and other systems. What is your impression of the foster care system? Did you spend time in foster care growing up? Did you age out of the foster care system? What was that transition like? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Daniel Hatcher, University of Baltimore law professor, about his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. You can be part of our conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You can phone us at 410-662-8780. Mark has phoned us from Baltimore. Mark, welcome to Midday.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure, you're loud and clear.
All right, great. Thank you. Hi, Dan. I work now in the Child Advocacy Unit for Legal Aid here in Baltimore City.
Hello, Mark.
Hi. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that anything has changed. I have had to work with the Social Security people to push the state away from taking some of my clients' survivors' benefits. We recently, in the last couple years or so, lost, as I'm sure you're aware, a Court of Appeals case that we had won at the circuit court level where the taking of our client's property had been invalidated. The other comment that I wanted to make, Sheila, directly about something that you said, you pointed to a drop in the number of children who are in foster care statewide. That's happened as well in Baltimore City. And as all of the listeners can tell, none of the underlying causes of abuse or neglect, either addiction or poverty, of children have changed. The only thing that's changed is a willingness on the part of the state and on the part of the department to engage in risky behaviors that leave children in the community at risk of being further abused and neglected.
In other words, Mark, you're saying that the current policies tend more to leave children with their families than to take them out of the family and put them in foster care.
That's one way to put it. Another way to put it is that the current policies, up until the last few months at least, had a tendency to be more focused on providing Band-Aids to the adult guardians or parents, like paying a utility bill or providing a few hundred dollars in food money, and then advising the parents or guardians that if they come to the attention of the department again, then the bad things will happen, and these people then disappear, and the children disappear. We're not able to intervene because the children are not brought into court. Now, that has changed in the last few months as a number of children showed back up at hospitals with very severe injuries and frightening the bureaucrats that are at the top of the Baltimore City Department of Social Services into once again bringing children at risk into care.
Mark, you're raising very serious questions that we probably should look at in a full hour of Midday. If you would email midday@wipr.org so I can catch your contact information, I'd love to speak with you more about this off air and pursue it. But it's beyond what I think we are dealing with today about the funding of foster care. So I really appreciate your call. On Mark's first point that the money from federal benefits he sees is not going to children, that matches your own impression.
Right, and Mark also mentioned a case in Maryland that did go up to the Court of Appeals, and there was some partial, very significant success actually out of that case.
My understanding of that case matches the way Mark characterized it, that while the court did say young people should be notified, which is no small thing.
Right.
They basically said it's fine for the state to take these benefits.
An oversimplification, and the court did not really reach some of the core arguments like breach of fiduciary obligation, which I think is the most striking in this example. But the court found that the Maryland foster care agencies were violating children's constitutional due process rights
by not
telling them that they're even applying for benefits or how they were using the funds. So that then provides hopefully an ability that now you might be able to, where an advocate for a child, look for a different representative payee. It could be a relative, it could be a volunteer. You could have a senior citizen volunteer who wants to become a mentor for a foster child. You could have nonprofit organizations. You could have a law firm or an accounting firm providing pro bono assistance to step up and say, we want to actually help and then manage these funds for the children in a way that actually really benefits the children.
I want to talk to you more about that, we've talked about the courts, that branch of government, and looking at this issue in Maryland. I want to talk about how the legislature has looked at it. Last year in 2015, bills were introduced in both chambers of the Maryland General Assembly to create savings accounts, as you were just talking about, for qualified foster care children. Up to age 17, under this legislation, the state would have been able to collect all eligible benefits. From age 17 to 18, 40% of the federal benefits would be set aside into an account for the child. The amount set aside would have increased as a percentage as the child aged. By age 21, when kids age out of foster care, all of the benefits, 100%, would go into this personal account. Sam Malhotra, Maryland Secretary of Human Resources, testified that the department favored studying the potential impact of this bill before making changes.
While we believe it's well-intentioned, the unintended consequences of the passage of this unfunded mandate is that it would result in the department having to make budgetary reductions affecting not just a few, but all youth in care. We are not ready to do that, and without an identified funding source, of course. We know that this would jeopardize the level of care provided to the overwhelming number of youth in care who do not receive such benefits. The premise behind this bill, not applying federal funds to the cost of care, has not been enacted anywhere else in the nation, and Maryland should not experiment with such a plan without a thorough examination of how supportive resources and services can be provided to all, and not just 4% of the youth that are in question. This process, I believe, should be transparent and involve not only child welfare advocates, but also the foster youth themselves, and I believe they need a seat at the table as well.
Secretary Malhotra's reference to 4% is that that's the state says 4% of foster care children get some kind of federal benefit or would be eligible for some kind of federal benefit. But he has also testified, or the department has, that in almost all cases, I think they've said 99% of the cases, the federal benefits that they do get for particular foster care children do not cover the ongoing cost of that child's care and maintenance. So what is your reaction to that picture that he paints?
Sure. Well, and maybe starting with his last point that former foster youth should have a seat at the table, I 100% agree. In fact, there were former foster youth who testified in support of the legislation saying that we want our own funds to help ourselves. They testified how harmful it was when the foster care agency was taking their funds. I also should point out that something the Secretary stated is just legally incorrect, that he indicated this would lead to cuts. It's virtually a threat that if we if the agency stops taking funds from foster children, the agency is going to cut its funding, so it's going to kind of provide less services to other foster children. The state agency is legally required under federal and state law to provide these services, so that threat is just factually and legally incorrect. The cost of foster care is expensive, but the children's own funds are intended to help the children. Our foster care agency is cash-strapped and desperately needs more funds to provide better services from our state. But when you have a foster care agency trying to fund itself by taking resources from the very vulnerable children that it just deserves, that's counterintuitive at best.
That you're just listening to Daniel Hatcher. We're talking about his book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel Hatcher is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, specializing in child welfare policy and poverty law. You can be part of this conversation. Do you think the state has a legal duty to manage any assets that foster care children enter the system with? Do you think they should be used for the state's cost in caring for that child, or should they be held sacred for the child to use after they leave the foster care system? You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. There was another exchange I want us to hear. Secretary Malhotra was questioned by Prince George's Democratic Senator Reverend Anthony Muse, who said that he himself had bounced around among 11 foster homes before he was adopted as a child. Muse said that many kids come out of foster care set up for failure.
Those who get a chance, who get on their feet at age 22, 23, 24, for the rest of their lives, they're tax-paying citizens. They've paid back. I don't want to make it look like they are some kind of debt that can never be, you know.
Yep. Very thoughtful of you, Senator, but I have to say we don't look at it that way as well. You know, the state has a business to run, so to speak, a DHR, and these kids are our customers, and we have to take care of them, right? So it's an analogy, but it's the analogy that I understand. And we have to provide them with the best of service that we can as an entity and as an organization. So it's not that we are disputing the concept. The concept is absolutely right. Okay. But we have to see what impact it has on us to be able to deliver the services to the other 96% of kids that are also at some point in time going to come out.
Secretary Malhotra seemed there to be agreeing that the concept of setting aside at least a portion of federal benefits for eligible children is a good one. But the analogy that he says he's comfortable with is that the Department of Human Services should be run like a business. The kids are the customers.
I think it's an unfortunate analogy to think of foster care as a business, right? You know, these are agencies that their sole reason of existence is not to maximize revenue, but to maximize the welfare of the children that are in their care. And there's something striking that should be clarified as well is, you know, first, I already explained it's legally incorrect that the agency could cut funds if it stops taking the resources from the children. And what's happening when the-
hold that thought, because
sure.
I want to pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
You point out, and I'm sure you're legally right, that the state has an obligation to come up with the money for the care and maintenance that these children need. Under federal regulations and the state's court of appeals ruling we talked about a few minutes ago, the state is allowed to use these federal benefits. So I'm not quite, you seem to be asserting that they would have no choice but to go to general state revenues to come up with the money to care for these kids. And you haven't yet proved to me why it is wrong for them to use another revenue stream, that is to say, the revenue stream that's coming from the federal taxpayers in these federal benefits.
Well, maybe I can start explaining what the state is actually doing. The secretary points this out as a way of saying that this is resulting in increased revenue for the agency to provide additional capacity for children. That's actually incorrect as well. What's happening when the agency is taking the resources from children, first, not only is that, I think, just conceptually and morally and policy-wise a flawed policy, but it doesn't even result in additional fiscal capacity to the agency. The state is reducing funding to the agency dollar for dollar, essentially, based upon how much money that the agency takes from the children, right? So they're going after, you mentioned 4%, roughly the current number of children who are disabled receiving SSI benefits. There are other children receiving survivor benefits. The contract that the secretary, the Department of Human Resources entered with Maximus is targeting to increase that number of children determined disabled upwards to 20% of the population, right? And the report from Maximus actually described children as a revenue-generating mechanism. So the target is not even to provide additional services for those disabling conditions, but to take the funds as state savings.
Do you remember the other point that you were about to make when I interrupted you?
That was part. Even when the agency is taking the funds, it's not even helping the agency. It's resulting in savings to the state, not in any additional capacity to the agency itself.
And you've observed the Maryland budget flow pretty closely. I haven't, so I'm not disputing that. But what have you seen in other states? Can you make a blanket assertion that when federal benefits are sucked into the system, they end up not benefiting the children who are eligible for those benefits?
Some states have actually been worse than Maryland, have started sooner in hiring the revenue contractors. The amount of money, Maryland, the amount that they're looking to try to obtain from children is with, if their goal is met, about $6 million a year they want to take from abused and neglected children. Other states, it's larger. Florida, I believe the number is about $16 million. And also they've been involved with revenue contractors there as well. Some states, even more. Illinois is another state that's worked with revenue contractors, and they're going after much larger numbers, in part because the population of foster children is larger. And it's not limited to these benefits. States will even, Maryland will do this. States will even go after veterans assistance benefits to take those from children if they have parents who died in the military, rather than using those benefits to serve those children's best interests after the children die. They take it as state savings.
Deborah has called us from Baltimore. Deborah, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I'll try to be very succinct, but there's some comments that have been made and responses that haven't come in. You had said earlier that you were concerned as a taxpayer that you were funding benefits to the children. But if those benefits are Social Security benefits, those parents who are deceased have paid into Social Security. That's not taxpayer money. Those people have paid in for that. If there's a life insurance policy for a deceased parent that they purchased for this child to care for that child, that has nothing to do with taxpayer money. This money could be set aside for the child as they age in some type of a savings account to benefit the child when they do age out of the system, either for job training, for college, for whatever, as opposed to the child aging out impoverished.
Deborah, good points. And you're right. I was describing federal benefits from Social Security as entirely taxpayer funded. We could get into a long discussion of Social Security makeup and how much comes from taxpayers. But you're absolutely right that people do pay into that system. Daniel Hatcher, your response to Deborah?
I think Deborah makes some very good points, in particular with survivor's benefits. You know, these are their benefits that the parent earned for their dependents. They worked and paid into the systems, much like life insurance. And not only could a benefit like that, a survivor benefit, provide the cash benefit to help the child, that then those funds could be used to help plan for their transition out of foster care, but the emotional connection. My former client, Alex, the state never even told them that he was eligible for this survivor benefit or that it was going to take the funds. So that connection to his deceased father, the cash that it could have provided to help him in his struggle when he left care, but also that emotional connection, knowing my father worked, paid into the system, and left me this benefit, that's real, and that has an impact on a child. And again, as I mentioned before, it's not just survivor benefits, veterans assistance benefits. They'll take if a parent died in the military, and if that parent didn't earn the benefits, I don't know who does.
We need to take another quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the foster care industry and other social agencies and the practice of targeting recipients as a source of federal funds. You can join this conversation. Are state governments doing enough to prepare children who are not reunited with family members or adopted? Should we do more? What are your thoughts on this? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Daniel Hatcher, University of Baltimore law professor, about his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. And Donna has called us from Baltimore. Donna, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
And your comment?
Hi, I'm losing you. I can barely hear you, but I can talk if you can hear me.
We hear you fine.
Okay, so I just wanted to play devil's advocate a bit. Not that I disagree with Mr. Hatcher, but I just sort of wanted to point out the other side since there's only one panelist on your show. And here's what I wanted to bring out, that when the federal benefits that you all are discussing, SSI benefits on one hand and survivor benefits on the other, are provided by the federal government for the support of children because their parents can't come up with that support. So in other words, if a child is living at home and their parent dies, they get survivor benefits so that wherever they are, that person can use that money to support the child. And at the same token, if you get SSI benefits, that's because you're disabled and you require additional money for your care and treatment. So now, if a child is in foster care, then the state or state federal combined is required to, number one, support that child so that theoretically they wouldn't need survivor benefits because that's the purpose of survivor benefits, and B, they're required to provide the care and treatment for whatever disability they have so that the SSI payments that's what they were intended to do. So if the state is taking over that responsibility, then they feel that they are entitled to those payments, because that should be coming out of the state's coffers anyway for foster children. Now, of course, there's another story where if the state isn't providing adequate care, they're not really giving what the child should be having, that's another issue.
Okay, Donna, I hear your point. I'm not quite sure in what way you're devil's advocate. Daniel, maybe you can respond to Donna.
Sure. So I Donna's point, I think, goes towards if you have a parent or a relative who is either getting a survivor benefit on behalf of a child or SSI benefits, that money then, that parent would be able to use the funds to help provide for the care for the child in the household where the child lives. And that's absolutely—
The ongoing care.
The ongoing care, and that's absolutely correct. And it's a good analogy and comparison, because what that does then for a struggling household is it provides more money for that household where the child lives to provide better care for the child, disabling needs if it's a child with SSI benefits based on the disability, or more assistance if a parent died and then you have survivor benefits. So you have more care into the total household funds available to care for the child. By comparison, what the state is doing is not that. When the state takes the SSI, the disability or survivor benefits from a child, it results in no benefit whatsoever to the foster care child, right? It doesn't result in any additional benefit for the child, any additional resources to the child, or any additional resources to the household where the child lives, which could be a foster care home.
So you're saying that you would not set the standard that in a family setting, a household setting, an adult ought to save into a special account, not touch till the child is older, a survivor's benefit, the way you're advocating that the foster care system ought to be saving these benefits in an account for the child. You're saying there's a different standard.
Well, it's the same standard, but it's a different circumstance, because you have the parent adult who's in that household with the child, and money comes in and it's available to help care for the child. And the parent, as a representative payee, then can decide, all right, this may be needed some for the best interest of the child to provide for current care. There may be enough to save for college. The grandmother of the child who brought the case out of Washington State actually went up to the Supreme Court. That grandmother luckily was able to fight enough at the state level to conserve the funds so her grandchild could go to college. And that was her effort as a representative payee, right?
Donna, I really—
what a parent does.
I really appreciate you posing the question. You got the answer that I was struggling to get earlier. I appreciate the question. I'm not sure I'm persuaded, but I do now understand the argument better. Casey has called us from Baltimore. Casey, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you today? I think this is a wonderful topic that you're speaking about, especially with a lot of the funds that seem to be, you know, that seem to be funneled away from the child in Baltimore City. You know, when you have secretaries or department heads like Molly Tierney that are running these departments, but that's looking at these children simply as numbers and, you know, bottom line figures, it becomes problematic. And that's how you have so many deaths since January just in Baltimore City of young children that were improperly placed or where funds, you know, were diverted to other things. So I think, you know, it's a great conversation, and someone really needs to look at Molly Tierney and wonder why we treat children like numbers instead of actually fixing the problem.
Casey, thanks for calling. Molly is not with us, so I'm going to say I've had some wonderful conversations with Molly, and I would not characterize her as treating children as numbers. I don't know whether you want to comment, Daniel.
Well, the comment I can make is I think foster care caseworkers do heroic work. They try under very low budgets, low pay, extraordinarily high caseloads to provide the services that are needed. And so the frontline workers want to do what's best for their clients. Where you see the diversion of funds is happening more at the state level, often even beyond the agency at the state level. Again, you know, I think a lot of agency personnel don't even realize that when they're taking the SSI, the survivor disability benefits, that it's actually not even providing any additional capacity to the agency, but rather in state savings. Our foster agency needs more funds to provide needed services. And I think there's been excellent improvement in Maryland over the years. We still need to improve even more. It's just taking resources from abused and neglected children isn't the answer.
That's Daniel Hatcher, University of Baltimore law professor, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. And we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780. Elizabeth has called us from Dundalk. Elizabeth, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Elizabeth, you're
Hello,
on the air. Elizabeth,
you're
there? On. Yes, Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. Question is, I realize that the system is currently broke, but my question is what should parents do with keeping in mind that no one ever wants their kid to go into foster care, but if what should we do with our funds in order to, on the off chance that our kids are put into this care if we die unexpectedly, how can we make sure that the funds will actually get to our child? I mean, is it a simple thing of we needing to get a guardian or something for it ahead of time, or is there anything we can do to prevent the problem basically from getting worse?
Elizabeth, thanks for the question. Daniel Hatcher?
I think it's a great question, and there are strategies that a parent or grandparent, often or other relative, could take to protect a child's resources. There's as mentioned, you could have a trust set up, something called a special needs trust. Just recently, as of last year, there's a new bill enacted called the ABLE Act at the federal level that allows for children's disability benefits to be conserved in a 529 plan. It's actually called a 529A plan, but the 529 plans, these are college savings accounts. So those very same vehicles are now available for disabled children.
The Baltimore Sun wrote about that just this week.
Right. So and you can have the savings for these disabled children's benefits and these 529A plans that receive the same tax benefit as the school savings accounts. They are exempt from some of the resource limits that might otherwise apply to disability benefits. And the uses that are available for the children's disability benefits are much expanded even beyond education accounts. So not just that could they be used for education, but for pretty much unlimited means that would serve the child's disabling conditions. So there's the perfect savings vehicle in place right now that's available. All we need to do is to stop the state from taking the funds and to use these monies for what would actually help the children.
So that is a potential answer for a family which has the ability to save something or has some assets. You make some proposals for solutions to the system. What could you summarize for us that you think would fix the problem that you outline in the poverty industry?
Well, in the book I go through both on the foster care system and Social Security benefits and Medicaid, child support. There are several different policy reforms that can happen at the federal level and state level. The gist of it is fairly simple. It's that our agencies that exist to serve the vulnerable need to stay true to their purpose, right? That the maximization of public welfare needs to take priority over maximization of revenue. And we've lost our way in terms of government going after revenue rather than serving those in need. And that doesn't just cause direct serious harm to the individuals who are impacted by it, but it can cause a loss of trust in what the government's doing when it's engaged in that kind of behavior.
I admire your persistence in proposing solutions, because as I look at your results so far in your home state of Maryland, minimal victory. One of our callers characterized it as a loss before the Court of Appeals, and the legislation that we spent some time talking about passed the Senate, as I understand, but did not pass the House, and there was nothing like it introduced in this most recent session of the General Assembly, or if so, I missed it.
This just most recent past session there was, and again, there was more success on the Senate side than on the House, and I'm hopeful that it will be brought back again, and that may go through in Maryland. And this I wish the legislation would go even further, right? This was a bill that would have protected some of the funds for those children who are getting close to aging out of care,
right?
And the state was even unwilling to support that the foster care agency actually hired a huge law firm to look for arguments against the legislation, spent more state dollars, I guess, looking at a way to battle legislation that was simply trying to protect children's funds.
So the question I'm trying to ask is, looking at those results so far in this state, I don't know what kind of efforts have been made in other states. Why do you think that there's any sentiment for changing this system that you say is pretty widespread and goes pretty deep in most states to take these federal benefits into the agencies that are taking care of kids?
I think that's an excellent question. I think largely this has been happening both with foster children's benefits and other issues with Medicaid benefits, because most people have no idea it's occurring. With awareness, we can bring change, right? As people become aware that this practice is occurring, everybody I've talked to about this, on a personal level, everything, they are at least troubled by the practice, if not outright outraged by the practice that's occurring. So with increased awareness, the possibility for change is wonderful, is enormous, that we really want to care about doing what's right for the most vulnerable among us. These are children. I mentioned veterans assistance benefits before. Another connection to that is foster children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans, right? These are children that need assistance as they age out of care. And we have their own funds. The children could actually benefit from their own money to help themselves and not just benefit from the money, a planning process. They can be engaged in financial literacy through this process of planning for the funds and really use it as a tool to help these children as they age out of care. That would be best for all of us as well, because as you mentioned at the start of the show, that would help result in fewer bad statistics that are lined up against children in terms of the number of children who end up unemployed or end up in the criminal justice system. It could help those children do better as they age out of care, and that in turn helps all of us.
I really appreciate your walking us through your reasoning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Danielle Hatcher's new book is The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens, just published this week by New York University Press. If you're interested in hearing more from Professor Hatcher, he has two events next week in D.C., next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at Busboys and Poets, and here in Baltimore next Thursday, June 30th, 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's Bookstore Coffee House on North Avenue. I want to thank you for listening. Tune in Monday in light of the acquittal this week of another police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray. We're going to look again at the question of what would justice for Freddie Gray look like. I hope you'll be with us for that discussion. Meanwhile, I hope you have a great weekend. I'm Sheila Cast.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.